addressed it today, you know, and it will keep pace with inflation.
John, in your testimony, Mr. Showalter, repeated what has been said in the news media many times during the past year and still going, that activities of the state, such as raising the taxes in any form whatsoever, causes them to want to leave the country and go elsewhere, and therefore development of our state resources will be curtailed. In your review, I don't know, it doesn't contain that in this booklet you sent it to us, but in reviewing matters concerning oil and tax increase, did you go over possibilities that this kind of thing that Russ was talking about, which makes people unhappy and they want to leave the state and they don't want to invest anymore in the state? Are there cases of that happening, at least the last couple of years?
Not that I'm aware of, and I just might mention that there was substantial testimony by experts last year on this very subject. And, you know, I think kind of the unanimous opinion of those experts was that these statements by the companies and their advertising, other statements and testimony about, you know, leaving Alaska or discouraging further developments, that's all they are, is statements. And that they make those sorts of statements wherever they go in the world. And they're always going to leave Alaska, or they're going to leave California, or they're going to leave whatever state they're in. But, you know, I don't think they've actually showed the actual cases of that happening. And, you know, the prime thing is, where is the oil? And, you know, how much money can they get for the oil once they get it out of the ground? And, state taxes is one cost, but it's a small element of the total picture. And the prime consideration is where is the oil, and what can they get for it? And as for this particular bill, what we're talking about is putting us back where we would have been last year if the company's own statements had been borne out in terms of how they reported. So we're not talking about anything more unusual than making the tax based, making the tax live up to what the companies themselves told us that the values were going to be and what we based our judgments on. I might mention that the House Resources Committee, in their committee substitute, eliminated the automatic escalator, which we had originally put in our bill. And as I've stated, I think that's very important, so that we keep. For two reasons. One is, we need to set the floor at a realistic level to protect state revenues, but we should also make sure that that keeps pace with inflation and the price of oil. And the escalator would do that. And in addition, as I mentioned, we also think that it has the element of adding some stability to the severance tax, rather than an annual review and an annual recommendation as to what the appropriate level, since the effect of inflation, as evidenced, that the floor would be tied to, will be a fairly stable and predictable element that can be used in the calculations. And one, two reasons. One is, protect the state on a continuing basis, not just in this year, and it would add an element of stability. Also, as Mr. Showalter has stated, and as the companies have stated before other committees this year on this particular provision, one of the arguments that they have used is that if indeed their transportation charges are unreasonable, that those judgments will come out in the wash in terms of the ICC proceeding, which is now the FERC proceeding, and the courts, that royalty questions are being litigated, and that if in the future those items are resolved in favor of the state, then the state will get refunds before the production tax, and we don't need this protection. And I guess my response to that is that we need the protection now, not only just for the transportation charges, but for other ways in which the wellhead value might be reduced. And I believe that the cents per barrel floor, which we proposed last year and this year, is a fair representation of the market value of our oil. And regardless of how those decisions on transportation are ultimately determined by federal agencies or the courts, I think it's important to consider that last year when the legislature set the level of taxation under the severance tax statute, it made those decisions based upon information that it had available at that time as to how much revenues would be raised from these, under those rates, based upon wellhead values as used by the industry and third-party sources. And I think this bill would just bring us back to where we would have been had these actions had these representations actually come to pass when the companies began filing their reports. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Question, Mr. Rowe.
Well, obviously, John, as a result of this bill should pass, the result would be that it would fatten the state treasury, which is already a surplus. So my question would be, is it the administration policy to reduce personal taxes? Is it planned to increase the bureaucracy with it? Or is it going to be used to discourage the production of marginal fields and exploration?
I guess I would say none of the above.
Well, it's the administration's bill. The reason I'm asking you, and apparently you're testifying for the administration.
Our position is that this bill is needed to protect revenues, which have been eroded by the actions of the companies in their transportation charges. And we need to. This just brings us back to where we would have been last year under our severance tax. We're talking about a protective measure.
Well, you're just taking in more revenue. My question is, what are you going to do with the revenue, period? Really, this is what the question is.
LA will spend it.
Totally sure it was.
Write more regulations. To answer, Mr. Chairman, if I might, to answer your question, this last year the governor added personnel to the state, almost $14 million worth of added personnel, and that's where the money's going to go. Over the past 4 years, it has exceeded $55 million in added personnel over a four-year period.
Mr. Meekins?
Yeah. Well, does revenue have any projections on the long-term revenue and expenditures of the state? I know you have them out in 1985. Do you have not any more than that?
We're working on some revenue projection that would go farther than that, but they're not completed yet.
Well, have you seen the three sets of projections that are available? I think ICR did one, and the legislature, legislative finance and legislative affairs both did projections out to the 1990s. Have you seen those?
I saw them originally, but I can't remember what they were.
Well, it's not really relevant to this bill too much, but it was brought up by Representative Rhodes, is that, you know, we will be, according to those, we will be in surplus, have a surplus in the 1980s, but by 1987, we'll start deficit spending. And by 1992, we'll be $2 billion in the red. So you can say, as Leo said, that we have these surplus, and this is just adding to the surpluses, but it's a real short view, because if you're looking at surplus, you're looking until 1985 or 1987, which is 9 years, which is a real short view when you're looking at resources that are infinite in the sense that they're very finite in the sense that they're here now, and for all the rest of the history of the state, whatever benefit we're going to get from it, we've got to derive while they're being produced. And for 8 years, we'll be in surplus, but it's directly a result of the speed at which we produce the oil. If we reduce the production to 1,000 barrels a day, there wouldn't be any surplus. But it would be drawn out over maybe 100 years. If we doubled the production, there'd be twice as much surplus, but it would be in shorter years. You have to look at the whole production of the whole field, and if you do that, even reducing spending to the lowest rate that has increased in the last 10 years, we're in deficit by 1992, $2 billion in the hole. And I think you have to look at it longer than that, Leo, than just the 1985 projection.
Yeah. But what I'm afraid of, if the surplus, we're going to build a bureaucracy that will quit.
We already are.
We probably will be in trouble. I agree with you. I think we'll be in
trouble. Well, you're right. I agree with you.
But I can't accept the doom and gloom, though, because I imagine 300 years ago somebody sat on a bar stool in Medford, Massachusetts, and says when we harpoon the last whale, the lights will go out. We still got
the whales have to get it.
We still got the whales. And that technology's going to change in the next.
The lights haven't gone on in some places.
I move we adjourn.
Hold it. Who made the motion to adjourn? Don't do that.
Well, we were doing it.
No, I'll make that mistake. Mr. Green?
I just wanted to comment on that the spending limit resolution we passed through this committee, Leo, which took into account that there the so-called surplus was largely tied up in the loan funds. So what we're not talking about, if it's a surplus, it's very liquid. And that, well, I agree with some of the loan funds, in fact, with most of them, because it isn't going into bureaucracy, it's actually going out to the private economy. One of the problems we're facing within 2 years, if the drawdown on the so-called general fund surplus continues, in 2 years there won't be any general fund surplus. Period. It'll all be used in the loan fund. So the balance that I've seen used in some of the advertising isn't really accurate if you consider the fact that it isn't available for appropriation for bureaucracy to anything else. It's tied up in loan funds, which is okay, but it isn't liquid. And that's something we should bear in mind.
Further question, Mr.
Yeah, I was just going to comment on that. Is that we've done some recent looking in terms of predicting our liquid balance in the next couple of years, and by the end of 79, it looks like we could be in a pretty tight situation because of the illiquid part of a surplus. And the majority of that will be tied up in loan funds, and if there's any further decline or in the wellhead values, we'll be in worse trouble. So that surplus, you do have to remember, a good part of that is illiquid funds tied up in the loan programs.
Further question, Mr. Messenger? No, thank you very much. Are there other witnesses that wish to testify on this bill? All right, in that case, we're close to session time. In that case, we will recess the meeting until 1:15 and continue with the bill. It's called the meeting to order. We're short one member for four. We can't take any action. We can go ahead with the hearing of testimony. We've had that. Somebody else. Let's go back to continue on House Bill 878, Oil and Gas Act. I believe you wanted to, would you take the seat and give your name for the record?
My name is Larry Vavra. I represent Union Oil Company of California. I'd like to present some testimony on House Bill 878. The present status of the bill, I believe, is that the automatic deflator index to increase the severance tax has been dropped out by the previous committee. However, testimony this morning by a representative of the administration indicated he advocates the inclusion of this particular measure back in. However, as an alternative, the Department of Revenue will appear more or less on an annual basis to suggest a modification of that same percentage increase, notwithstanding the deletion of the index to increase this. In light of the circumstances, I'd like to present the following testimony, which includes a little historical bit dealing with what an automatic inflator does as far as the taxes are concerned, with special consideration to how it affects an oil field with a prices controlled by the federal government. At the 1973 special session of the legislature, extensive changes were made to the oil and gas production tax. The concern of the legislature in 1973 was that oil prices would drop, and if the prices dropped, the state's revenue would drop. Thus, the legislature kept the percent of value rates of the tax, which would permit the state to obtain as a tax a part of any increase in prices. And to protect against the drop in prices, the legislature also decided to retain the alternative cents per barrel tax, which assured at least a minimum level of tax irrespective of the price. However, the legislature further introduced a totally new concept, which tied increases in the cents per barrel rates to increases in the wholesale price index of oil. Here the idea was that because oil prices in the United States were generally rising due to the activities of the OPEC nations, the cents per barrel rates too ought to rise to keep pace with the rise in prices. The legislation took effect January 1, 1974, and before the ink was even dry on the bill, it became very clear that this escalation provision had a major flaw that would provide an unintended windfall to the state. The reason was very simple. Prices for the vast bulk of oil production in Cook Inlet were frozen by government control. Thus, what happened was the cents per barrel rate immediately began escalating because the wholesale price index immediately began rising. But oil prices in Cook Inlet did not move, and indeed could not move. The theory of escalating tax rates simply could not apply to Cook Inlet because the prices were frozen for the vast bulk of the lower tier production, and movements in the index had absolutely no relationship to most all of Cook Inlet production. The cents per barrel rates set out in the statute are a matter of record, so I won't go into that. However, when the wholesale price index was applied, these rates jumped about 50% by the end of the first 4 months of 1974. By the end of 1975, the rates had jumped 75%, and by the end of 1976, the effective rate stood at about 80% above the base rates. Union Oil Company was a prime victim of these escalating tax rates through prices of its crude oil production, though prices of its crude oil production were frozen. Most of Union's production at Cook Inlet is lower tier oil at MacArthur River Field. For the 1974-75, price remained at $4.65 a barrel. In 1976, a small rise to $4.885 was allowed. And in late in 1977, a small increase of 4.915 and 4.945 were allowed. Similar experience existed with other production at other locations. Thus, for the 3.5 years, the cents per barrel tax rates for Union kept rising, while most of our production prices were frozen for the 74 and 75, with only a token increase totaling about 20 cents per barrel allowed during the last year and a half. When the law was changed at the end of the 1977 session, the new 60 cents per barrel rate inserted was nothing more than the original rate that had already escalated, plus an amount to arrive at the 60 cents per barrel. This brings us to the bill which is before you now. There's a comment here dealing with section 2 of the bill, and as I've stated, though the automatic deflator increase has been deleted, it's been suggested it be re-included or that an annual modification to that effect will take place. Section 2 of the bill seeks to put an escalating factor back into the law. This time, instead of the wholesale price index of oil, it's to be the gross national product deflator index. But the inequity to Union and other producers of controlled oil is just as predictable as it was under the old law, because the prices of oil are still under government control. The deflator index would be an automatic guarantee to an increase in tax rates unless one believes this country will have no more inflation. If one believes that inflation will continue, then the tax rates would automatically increase. As to Cook Inlet producers, the rates would produce on the false premise that the rates would increase on the false premise that the rates would keep pace with oil prices, when in fact oil prices can move only with governmental approval. Movements in the deflator index, or any index for that matter, have absolutely nothing to do with Cook Inlet production and have no correlation with Cook Inlet prices. The bill sets a beginning or base rate of not 60 cents per barrel, but 63.4 cents per barrel for Cook Inlet type crude. The idea here is that because the deflator index has risen 5.7% since last year, the beginning rate should reflect that increase too. But the same fallacy exists. Using a beginning rate of 0.634 assumes that the base oil price at Cook Inlet have risen by an equal percentage amount, which is simply not true. The price of Union's crude at MacArthur River Field was 4.885 cents for the first 7 months of 1977. In September, the price rose 3 cents and another 3 cents in October for a total rise of 6 cents, or about 1%. Since 1974, the total rise for the entire 4 years has been only 6%, compared with the 80% jump in tax rates over the base rate. The bill also applies to North Slope production as well as gas production. The deflator index applies to that production too. Last year, the severance tax on North Slope oil productions was increased about 50%, and the severance tax on gas was increased approximately 150%. While some may argue that Cook Inlet oil production was not affected as much as the North Slope production, this is really an illusion, because when one looks at the history of the severance tax legislation, tax proponents will be quick to point out that the cents per barrel rates for old oil in effect at the time of the passage last year, in May or June of 1977, were not at all that far below 60 cents per barrel inserted in the law. However, the true comparison should be to what the rates should have been back in 1973, before the escalation of tax rates took place on production that could not rise in price. Those increased rates and added taxes for the 3.5 years represented a windfall to the state, as Union views it. Those added taxes were unintended, because the idea back in 1973 was to protect the state against a drop in prices and it was not intended that the state profit from rising rates in cases where the price of oil had no chance to rise due to governmental action. Viewed in this light, the 60 cents per barrel floor inserted last year was more than a 100% increase over what the rate should have been if the real intent of the law in 1973 had prevailed. What really happened last year was that the tax rate existing under the law was simply inserted into the new law, plus a little more to bring it up to the 60 cents per barrel. We do not accept the notion that Cook Inlet received no significant tax increase on oil production. The law simply codified the state increases that were not intended in the first place, and then added some more to those rates. As to gas production, the rate for severance tax went up last year from 4% of value to 10% of value, a 150% increase. This is somewhat misleading. During the lunch break, I talked to the representative of Chugach Electric. The rates they're paying for an MCF of gas out of the Beluga field, presently being 24 cents per MCF, puts their tax at around 26% rather than the stated 10% of value. The alternative tax of 6.4% per MCF inserted in the law meant that any gas sold for less than 6.4 cents per MCF would, less than 64 cents per MCF would pay the alternative rate. Thus, the 10% of value rate is illusory if the gas is sold for less than 64 cents per MCF because of the effective rate is higher. The bill seeks to raise the floor from 6.4 cents to 6.8 cents using the same 5.7 inflation factor in the deflator index since last year. The future deflator index change would then begin to apply to the base at the 6.8 cents per MCF. The automatic setting of a minimum rate on oil or gas production based on some sort of moving index represents the substitution of judgment, which lacks reality, to the marketplace because the index change does not track with the change in the price of the commodity actually being taxed. Percentage of value rates, which apply in the market price of oil and gas, at least move with the realistic value and provide the taxing jurisdiction with a means of capturing as tax a part of any increase in prices. If the taxing authority believes it needs protection against reduced revenue due to reduced prices, then it can set a minimum level if the minimum level is truly looked at as a protective device. In a falling market, that protective device may at some point collide with and be inconsistent with the forces affecting the market, and it becomes a matter of which interest the taxing authority wishes to protect. Trouble comes when a minimum level of tax is not structured as a real protective device, but rather is structured to ensure a level of tax which has no real bearing on the market price. There is simply a substitution of judgment for the market price based on some preconceived idea that either the worth of the commodity being taxed or the level of the tax revenue desired without regard to the market itself. In the case of Cook Inlet production, late in 1973, the idea was to set a minimum tax to protect the loss of revenue due to price drops in the wholesale price index. It was also inserted on the notion that the commodity to be taxed would rise in price with the index. However, Cook Inlet prices did not rise, and the higher taxes were levied on assumed increasing values that never materialized. The amount of taxes that resulted bore no relation to the amount intended under the law, because the actual marketplace rules were different from those assumed under the theory of the index. If the deflator index is put into the law, the same situation experienced by Cook Inlet oil producers with the old wholesale price index will occur again to cause automatic tax increases on non-existent increases in oil prices. The same will be true for the gas sold under fixed price contracts, where the sale price requires the application of the cents per MCF tax calculation. But even aside from the situations where an index of any sort would do a particular mischief, the concept of an index is faulty because it would only be by coincidence that the change in whatever index is used represents a change in the price of the commodity actually being taxed. The legislature presently has evidence that the tax burden on oil and gas producers in Alaska is the highest for the major producing states. Last year's severance tax increase help to assure that position. By whatever standard one chooses to measure present Alaska severance tax rates, they are extremely high, and union can see no justification for any increase in rates. Union rejects the idea using an automatic index to escalate the cents per barrel rates after the experience it and others have had under the prior law with the wholesale price index. There is no place in Alaska law for such a device having this type of punitive effect on a producer. Surely enough experience has already occurred with uses of indexes to learn that they have a distorting and indistinguishable effect on taxpayers. Now, in the testimony that I presented before the House Resources Committee, I stated that our average price per barrel from Cook Inlet for February and March was $4.94 a barrel. In reviewing those figures with our operations people on a recent trip to Anchorage, we found an inconsistency, and it appears that the average was $5.24, though 30 cents low. At first we thought this was due to the fact that we'd brought on some new oil wells that had been down for repairs, and it turned out that's not the case. The people running the numbers had overlooked some quote-unquote new oil production. So actually the statement that I made before House Resources was 30 cents in error. We have an additional problem that many people are not aware of, and it deals with producers that are coupled with the burden of having the old oil price restriction. In its wisdom, the federal government has determined that an appropriate price for oil produced is approximately $8.51 in this United States. And the difficulty that we experience is that for every barrel of oil that we produce under the old oil or the 524 average, we're obligated to pay the upper tier producers $3.27 for every barrel. This burdens Union Oil Company to the extent that for 1 month alone, our cash flow was $10 million in this regard. So people that feel that since we have a low rate and transfer a good bit of our production to our refining and then onto the marketing people think this is any bargain, it certainly isn't. Since we're obligated to pay this $3.27 a barrel for every barrel we produce under the old oil. To compound this situation, we're being taxed at a higher rate than we're allowed to charge for the oil, and our pleas with the Department of Revenue have thus far fallen on deaf ears. It's been suggested that the oil industry, not only union but others, should take this problem up with the federal government and resolve it at that level and allow the price of oil to escalate to what would be a reasonable rate. We're certainly in favor of this. However, any efforts thus far have been 100% unsuccessful. It would seem to me that it would generate a good deal more revenue for the state if, in fact, they would join in our quote-unquote lobbying effort to allow the old oil prices to escalate, and thereby the wellhead value could increase, so at least some portion of this $3.27 a barrel. On the contrary, it seems to be the efforts of the state at the present time to tax producers to whatever rate or percentage they see fit, and we wind up in the proverbial between a rock and a hard spot situation. It's been suggested that as a result of the severance tax bill that was passed in the last session, that it was taken into consideration of lower producing wells, the marginal wells, etc. And though we do appreciate the break that some of the marginal wells did receive from this, one often gets the impression that this severance tax increase a year ago was quote-unquote a real blessing for the industry. I'd like to point out that MacArthur River, which is approximately 60% or so of the present Cook Inlet production, certainly doesn't experience any great benefit because of the production rates of those wells. MacArthur River was subjected to a very substantial tax increase. With MacArthur River being 60% of Cook Inlet, and Cook Inlet plus or minus 5% of the total production in the state presently, we wind up with the conclusion that about 95% of the production in Alaska had a very substantial tax increase only a year ago. And now we are confronted with an additional increase. It was stated earlier today in testimony, and actually in response to a question, that As far as the Department of Revenue was concerned, certainly no one had been chased out of the state because of the high tax rates. I suggest that perhaps there's a lack of communication between the industry and the Department of Revenue, for though in fact no one may have been chased out, many have been kept out, many are halfway out the door, and we are continually forced to compete with the other states in which our companies operate, which offer a better deal or a more optimistic picture or an opportunity to go explore for, discover and produce oil under much more favorable conditions. It was stated for the record that some time ago that the number of wells, exploratory wells in the state of Alaska was horribly insignificant amount compared to those drilled in other states. Again, in 1977, the total was only 27 exploratory wells in the state compared to a substantial number more in other states. Of these 27 wells, approximately a dozen were wells drilled on federal leases in the Gulf of Alaska or under a federal exploratory program on NPR-4, neither of which, to my knowledge, have produced any significant or encouraging results. This is the conclusion of the statement that I have. I'll be happy to try and answer any questions that anybody has in regard to this.
Thank you, Mr. Deacon.
Yeah, Larry, you know, I was on that pre-conference committee that fashioned that escalator in 1973. In fact, I voted with the prevailing side on the pre-conference committee and also in the legislature that passed it. And I agree with you. I think, you know, that your comments about the problems that came up once the two-tier system and the freezing of those prices, we're not really anticipate those at all. The attempt there was to, we weren't really so worried about the value of the oil increasing as we were the wellhead value decreasing because of shifting profits. This was, the consultants came in and made a lot of, there's a lot of testimony about the vertical integration allowing profit shifting, and that was sort of the general concept that at least those of us on the pre-conference were looking to. But in any case, I think you're right, and I think that, you know, it doesn't make any sense to tie an escalator to an index that doesn't reflect the value of the commodity you're trying to tax, because that's what the effort is, and it's absurd to do that, and we've seen the problems that come up with it. But I think the general idea of putting an escalator in, if you could tie it to the value of the commodity, would be reasonable in the respect that I don't think it's good for you or for the legislature to have to fight a battle every year whether or not a certain tax should increase. I think that's an instability that the industry doesn't need. They won't really know what's going to happen to their taxes year by year. I think the concept is good. It's just that the tying it to the index that doesn't make any sense.
I agree with that, and there's presently a mechanism available whereby the tax could be applied to the price depending upon what the price happens to be at any given time. The bill passed by the legislature a year ago has a percent of value provision in the tax. The unfortunate problem is that we've got a floor that's artificially high. I would suggest the way to solve this problem is to reduce the floor down to pick up the effective level of the tax at your 12.25%. I mean, the effective rate is going to be somewhat below 12.25, but to explain this a little further, reduce the 60-cent floor, which actually is not a 60-cent floor, it's a 64-cent floor by the time you have a gravity correction. Mm-hmm. That gravity correction we don't get any more money from anybody because we have a controlled oil price. But reduce the floor on controlled oil down to where the percent of value actually takes effect. And then let that ride with any price increase that may occur.
Well, I don't mind that. The problem is I don't want the value of the oil to, the indicator of the value of the oil to be the wellhead value, because I think you've got a problem there because of differences in transportation charges and there definitely is a possibility in some circumstances to take profits at different areas. I think that if you tied it to the to the value that was the frozen, refinery value or whatever it is where the ultimate sale is, if you tied it to that value, it would make more sense. Like if the regulated price is $5 and it goes up 10%,
then it seems to me like the floor ought to go up 10%.
Well, I see your problem. We're talking about apples and oranges here. We've got a production tax, and we're also considering increased value, so therefore you're borderline on an income tax. When that barrel of oil is produced out of the well at Cook Inlet, it's sitting there in the barrel. It isn't worth any more than the $4.94, if it happens to be our average, $5.24. For barrel, you've got to have your corporate transportation system, your refineries, your marketing people, all this to tack on this increase. Now, this is accounted for and taken care of, utilizing, I hate to open this can of worms when we're talking about a severance tax, but utilizing the multi-state tax compact. We are subjected to increases and ultimately pay tax on the income that we make on this commodity. Yeah. Union Oil, for example, it's been argued and suggested, threatened, what have you, that the state of Alaska is just not getting what should be attributed to them via this particular mechanism. Well, the ratio that we use under the multi-state to compute the taxes that we pay in this state is the third highest of any state that Union Oil operates in. Now, it's suggested that, you know, due to some of the inadequacies in this formula, the state should be getting more revenue, a higher percentage, this sort of thing. We have a vast investment in California, both in real property, production, and personnel. This, of course, is the state that gets the number one ratio under the multi-state. In Chicago, we've got refineries, a vast marketing complex, and since we adapted the Pure Oil Company, we have a vast amount of employees there. Realistically, this is state number two. The state of Alaska, where we have a very limited number of employees, quite a bit of production, and though we do market here, quote-unquote limited sales, this is the third highest state for the multi-state tax compact formula. So our concerns, I feel, in regard to what value we add to increase this barrel of crude oil before it goes to the consumer is adequately reflected by this multi-state thing, and I think the state does get a shot at that. Well, so what we're dealing with here is a severance tax, a production tax, and as long as the federal government says, okay, it's going to be $4.94 a barrel and that's it, let's get back to where the percent of value applies to this $4.94, and if the price goes up a nickel or a dime or a dollar, the percent of value goes right along with it, with this 12.25. Now, I realize the ELF factor is going to have some effect on the 12.25.
Okay, but the $4.94, that's not the wellhead price.
Yeah.
It is.
It's a controlled wellhead price by the federal government.
Oh, I see.
I wish that it weren't. I'd be delighted with an 851. It's what they're trying to equalize it at.
Yeah.
And if we were at the 851, we'd be paying under the percent of value. We wouldn't be paying this $3.27 to some other oil company, which generates no income for the state of Alaska, and granted none for ourselves. It's a great idea to get the price up to the 851, which is the stated price of the thing. But
I don't want to get into the specifics because we don't have enough time. But it just seemed to me that I'm agreeing with your the problems you have with the index. I think that's reasonable. But I still like the idea of an escalator. I don't like the idea of having to fight taxes, oil taxes every year, because it's just a waste of time when you don't need to. And if there's some kind of, there's an alternative method where we can have an escalator once there's an agreed upon rate and somehow escalate it, because oil prices are going to continue to change and we need to have these automatic adjustments. And it seems to me that once we got something that was considered reasonable by a majority of the legislature, we could escalate that on some basis. And I think that would be a good idea, because I don't think the industry needs to have the severance tax is changed every year either.
Well, I'm having a problem with this. You know, we assume that the 12.25 was an adequate percent for a severance tax for the state of Alaska last year. I mean, the legislature assumed that was. I think it's inappropriate to put in some escalator that, through no control on either person's part, either industry or the legislature, can conceivably climb to 50% over a matter of a couple of years. We've seen where this thing, from the intended rate in 1973, went to 100% over just a very few years.
If it's tied to an index.
Absolutely. Right. What can we tie this to? It won't
tie to the value of the oil. And that's the only thing you can tie to that makes any sense. Right?
Okay, let's tie the 12.25 severance tax rate to whatever the government dictates we can sell that oil for.
And then as the price of the oil increases, you're going to have your 12.25% severance tax, minus, of course, whatever percentage the health dictates on the lower producing wells. And that, again, this is a situation where you can't really say it's going to be this number, because you say, okay, this well's producing 900 and this one's producing 301.
Well, I mean, but the, you know, not to get into extended debate, Mr. Chairman, but
we don't mind an extended debate.
The concept of a cents per barrel is to protect the state against a situation where, in extreme case, where the value of the oil at the market you know, would be increasing, but the wellhead value, because of accounting manipulations, would either stay the same or go down. And so the cents per barrel, the idea there was to have a floor so that if those kinds of manipulations happen, that the state, you know, couldn't arbitrarily be hurt because of accounting manipulations, and that it would be tied to the value of the oil. Now, you know, if there weren't any of those problems ever to arise, then you'd never need a cents per barrel. You could just go a percentage, and it would always work out. Percentage of the wellhead, and it would always work out. But if, to the extent that you believe you need a cents per barrel, then you have to tie it to something. You have to escalate it to something. So it seems to me that you ought to escalate the cents per barrel with the value of the oil.
Well, that gets us in a worse situation than exists right now. I mean, we're obligated to pay whatever the difference is between our control price and the $8.51 to some third party, which doesn't do anybody any good except the third party. Mm-hmm. And then we're taxed on $6.50 oil or something like that, when our price on the oil that we sell is $4.94 for the most part of our production. To add an escalator in there is going to only compound this error and this confusion, and be more burdensome on companies that have a controlled oil price. I would suggest the way to solve this problem, here's a chart right here that shows the increases graphed with the escalator that we hadn't put up with before. Mm-hmm. And it was a real nuisance. I mean, every month you'd get a new letter from the Department of Revenue that says, greetings, you now use percent number such and such, and you've just had another severance tax increase.
Well, the only point I'm making is that, you know, the logical conclusion from your remarks, if you accept your remarks is true, which I do, that the index doesn't make sense because it's not tied to the value of the commodity, then one must, you know, the logical conclusion is to tie it to the value of the commodity, and that's where I'm coming from. That's all I'm trying to say.
Further questions from the
table?
If not, thank you very much. Are there other witnesses here to testify on this bill?
Chairman, move and ask unanimous consent to report out House Bill 878.
House committee says House Bill 878. You heard the motion. Is there discussion? Is there objection? There is no objection. It's over.
Thank you.
You're running on the wrong ticket, Randy. You ought to change your public ledger. You and Tom Kelly make a good tag.
Well, everybody doing his own thing.
Save some money for those of us who can come.
One, two, three, four, five, six.
That's what you did. That's what he was moaning about.
All right.
Where is the guy who wants to move out?
House Bill 691. Mr. Guy.
Mr. Chairman, I've placed a packet before most of us here. All of us. 691.
Oh. Got it.
Yeah. You have it, Tom?
It says Ernie Hogan.
Well, he's a little pretty confident. So I send that to you. Got it? You have your copy? 691. Go. Chairman, on speaking to the company substitute for House Bill 691, I'd like to refer you to a letter to me from George Neck, community liaison of the Yukon Kuskokwim Health Corporation. Letter dated March 24, 1977, last year. I think the the main part of his letter lies on within paragraph 3, which speaks to the fact that all of the health facilities in the Yukon Kuskokwim region are leased by KHS, and those funds, leased funds, are used for fuel, insurance, electricity, janitorial and maintenance services, and basic sanitation. However, the size of the funds cover only the specific services listed, and other health services provided the community by alternate health aides and clinic manager salary, maintenance material, and other services are not covered by the lease, and therefore the extra expenditures have to come from the village council funds. And the revenue sharing law, as it is written, says that you have to expend up to $4,000 before you can become eligible to receive that amount. However, this past month I've learned that that what the Department of Community and Regional Affairs personnel do here is if a community has to expend $800 before it can be eligible to receive that 4,000 limit. Now, in the course of the deliberations within the Health Committee, proposed amendment to the AS 4318-010-I2 was amended, which basically says that if you spend a certain amount of money, even if not up to $800, your revenue sharing would be directly proportional to your expenditure. In other words, if the community right now, to get the full $4,000 limit, you have to spend $800. Okay, but the community, because it does not have enough funds, maybe they'll expend monies for the alternate health aides pay or for the managers, clinic managers pay, or some things like that. So therefore, the community spends $200. That's one fourth of $800. So therefore, the community would be eligible to receive a fourth of $4,000, which is $1,000. Now, a letter from Rosenstein Legislative Council to Representative Parr says, in part, the letter is also in the packet, in the folder that I made available to you. Here's what it says. The bill established a mechanism to reduce state aid to local government based upon the level of contribution it makes to the cost of operation and maintenance of health facility. So actually, the bill seems to be while it's helping a small community, it's still actually helping the bigger communities that have that many more funds. I guess that is about it, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Guy. Is there were you here to testify on this particular bill?
I'm sorry.
Mr. Buckholz?
The packet that Mr. Guy gave to us, Mr. Chairman, doesn't have the CS. Are you?
You have to pull out your CS from your files here.
I wasn't there when the U.S. Committee considered this bill, I think, or I may have been there, but you all the testimony. But Mr. Rosenstein's comment here, the last paragraph, which says, the last sentence says, thus, if a local government spends $1,000 and the health $600 or $6,000,
that's three quarters.
Three quarters of the full amount. So, if they only spend up to $600,000,
it's three quarters of $4,000. That's $3,000.
Yeah, then just three quarters. But if they spend over $800.
They still get the minimum or the maximum, depending on how you look at it, of $4,000.
You're almost compelled to spend your top dollar, like $800,000.
That's where
I'm
talking
in millions.
Yeah, we're not talking about that, Mr. Quiet.
I don't understand it. This is why I don't understand it.
Too small.
See, that's the problem that villages have is that they do not have, they may not have the $800.
Yeah, we're talking about the
minimum expenditure.
Mr. Guy could ask you a question. Yeah. Is there a fiscal note? What's the fiscal impact?
Well, I thought I had the fiscal impact is not very much.
The fiscal impact, would that be on the overall budget? The overall budget in this
department's
budget or?
Well, I guess according to some of the testimony I can recall, the fiscal note would be maybe almost zero because of the nature of and the language of the bill. It's because the bill established a mechanism to reduce state aid.
That's something we could have a staff check out for us.
Yeah, right.
The department may have it.
Mr. Rhodes, what?
I was just going to say, maybe the Parks Committee may have had it or got it. They may have it in their department.
That's something we could check out. Mm-hmm. Further questions of Mr. Guy?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I thought the purpose of Mr. Guy's introducing this bill is to gain help for his district, but
yep.
If the bill, as the last paragraph says, is establishes a mechanism to reduce it, I don't think that was his purpose.
No. It's the other way around. Like in George's next letter, he says that the extra expenditure usually does not exceed $4,000. The law says you have to expend $4,000 before you can be eligible to receive that. But we found out that the Department of Community and Regional Affairs allow for expenditure of $800 before you can be eligible to receive the $4,000.
Yes.
So, but some of the villages, according to George's letter, do not have that $800 and therefore are ruled ineligible or are not eligible for revenue sharing. So what the bill does is if the village spends an additional $400, that's one half of $800, so the village is entitled to revenue share of $2,000.
What you're saying, Philip, is that regardless of what village, or any village, if they spend $800, they're entitled to revenue sharing. If they spend at least that much, then they'd be eligible.
No. Right now, right. Well, they would be eligible to the full $4,000. Okay. But if they spend $400, if you don't have the $800, or maybe the expenditure was not necessary, they spend $400, then they're entitled to one half. That's $2,000. Better than nothing for these communities that do not have the money.
Mr. Schaefer.
Yeah, maybe just add a little bit. The revenue sharing thing is you have to, $4,000 to be entitled to that money, you have to spend at least 20%. Toward which is the $800.
Mm-hmm. You have to spend $800 if you were to
be eligible
qualify for the $4,000. You have to spend $4,000 in public facilities before you're entitled.
Help.
20% of $4,000.
In other words, if you don't come up with $800, you don't get anything.
Right.
And what Mr. Guy's bill would do, if you come up with
a raise
$400, at least you would get $2,000.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Director came up with
100.
Is this under the revenue? It's under the revenue sharing.
Further discussion. Mr. Rhodes had moved that we report the bill out. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
What will be the fiscal note?
Yeah, the fiscal note you're going to try.
And we'll make a note with the staff to check out the fiscal note.
Thank you.
would the committee be, just a second, let me check this. Someone just stay with us a minute.
What's the number?
Senate Bill 45, Radiation Protection.
Oh, we had that, didn't we?
Yeah, we've had it 14 times, no. We've had it before, we never could understand what they're trying to do. Give us a short explanation and we can do what we're going to do with it.
Chairman, members, my name is Sid Heiderstorf, I'm with the Department of Health and Social Services, the department that will receive some of the authority for radiation protection from the Department of Environmental Conservation. This is the basic intent of Senate Bill 45. Now, the reason I'm here, however, was not to discuss Senate Bill 45, but an amendment which was proposed, yes.
Is that the amendment that we have? I think everybody has it on.
This gentleman just gave me.
Signed by Chief Speckman.
Okay.
No.
Would you?
Environmental Conservation.
The amendment was, I'm not sure the source of that.
Representative Greening?
Okay, Representative Greening had an amendment.
We don't have it, huh? Well, that's what we're getting.
Anti-growth.
This amendment covers a couple of different kinds of radioactive materials. Basically, the ones that I wish to talk about, it mentions special nuclear materials and byproduct materials. Those are different classes of radioactive materials. The intent of this amendment, I believe, from what I can see, is to give to Alaska authority over licensing, control of, possession of all of these kinds of materials. Now, while this is certainly a legitimate area for legislature's involvement, the approach has many problems. And the amendment has very far-reaching legal ramifications. In at least one instance, it appears to be in direct conflict with existing federal law.
Could I ask you a question, sir?
Yes.
I'm not trying to be rude, there's a reason for it. Are you prepared to recommend and defend the amendment?
No.
All right. In that case, I think that it would be proper for us to, in fairness to Mr. Greening, to postpone further action on this until he can appear before the committee and defend his own amendment. Would anybody disagree with that?
No.
Not will
I would like to ask some question. Not necessarily just the general concept of this bill. I can read what it says it would do, but could you give to me in your own words what the purpose of it?
Yes. You're speaking of Senate Bill 45 and not the proposed amendment.
The amendment amends only a few lines.
Well, the amendment is drastically different from the purpose of Senate Bill 45. And one of the things I would hope that could be done would be to, if the intent is to pursue the issue presented by the amendment, would be to split this out into a separate bill, because this amendment will kill Senate Bill 45. That would be my prediction. It's very controversial. For example, it gives an individual citizen under the 060 injunction proceedings, it gives every citizen standing to stop any kind of a nuclear activity in Alaska, and that would, you know, that basically is a stacked deck to eliminate any kind of nuclear activity in Alaska. But Senate Bill 45, all that is intended to do is to resolve a situation which exists now. The Department of Environmental Conservation has statutory responsibility for all sources of radiation. Included in those sources of radiation are the medical and dental sources of radiation, microwaves, lasers, etc., that are not really environmental types of radiation. And that department has not been conducting any kind of activity in this field, and the purpose then was to
give to the Department of Health and Social Services the responsibility for the non-environmental type source of radiation. And in Alaska, it is precisely the medical and dental x-rays where the largest exposure to the general population exists. And so we certainly support Senate Bill 45. The amendment here, as I say, it raises issues that, from what I can see, the directly in opposition to the Atomic Energy Act of 1954, which specifies how the state must pursue the issue of being able to license. And one of the and it certainly does not say the state can simply pass a statute to do that. There are 25 states that have taken the appropriate steps to obtain the authority to license radioactive materials. I'm not sure I answered your question. Well, I was kind of throwing in the amendment plus the bill. I view the amendment as just totally a different kind of thing than the bill itself. They both deal with radiation, but the Senate Bill 45 simply is trying to clarify areas of jurisdiction where there are presently areas in the Department of Environmental Conservation. They don't want it. They have never done anything in the area. It's an important area of public health. The effort is simply made to turn it back to our department.
Okay. Well, I can see, Mr. Chairman, that there should be some regulations if nothing is done to regulate and monitor the x-ray machines and, you know, anything that is found in the medical facility. But when you start mixing it with atomic radiation and nuclear, you know, power and all this kind of thing, I don't know whether this is something we should address in two in one bill. I wonder if there's a way we could separate these two items then, because
just don't adopt that silly amendment.
Well, this is why I think we're waiting for Mr. Greening. This is why I wanted to know what the contents of this.
Yeah.
But even in this bill, in the CS, I see that you are trying to have some handle on nuclear devices as well. So.
No, that's under environmental conservation. You'll see that that's under Senate Bill 45 that you have there. They talk about, it simply lists those things that environmental conservation will keep responsibility for. Where it mentions the nuclear devices, you'll notice that's Title 46 rather than 18, which is our department.
Oh, okay.
You see on page 4 in the paragraph.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, if there's nothing further, we want to thank you, sir, for appearing, and we'll hold this bill until such time as Mr. Greening can be here and defend his own amendment. We will meet at 8:30 in the morning to consider some of the bills, as many as possible, that were announced today on the floor. Nothing further meeting here. The first item that we had on the agenda this morning was House Bill 882. We're short of quorum, but I understand we have a kind of film presentation that he made. Did you wish to start out with that? Or?
I'd like to have a brief introduction.
All right. Why don't you?
Why
get
we're
get
here.
A lighter.
You want a light?
Should I just sit in? Okay. My name's Clarissa Quinlan. I'm with the Division of Energy and Power Development. And we're here to request a supplemental appropriation for the Nelson Lagoon Wind Project. Before I give you a background, I'd like to introduce a couple of people that are here with me. One is Dick Henkel. He's the treasurer of Grumman Energy Systems in Conkuma, New York. And Mr. Frank Adler, who's project manager for wind programs for Grumman Energy Systems. In the 1976 legislative session, you provided our office with $250,000 for wind demonstration projects. Originally, we intended to try and do three of them, one in Kotzebue, Cole Bay, and Nelson Lagoon. As we got into the projects, because of the increased funding that was needed, we eliminated the Cole Bay project. We have constructed a small 2KW unit tied into the community college building at Kotzebue. We subcontracted that work to the University of Alaska. The machine is up. It's a Dunlight system, which has been on the market for years and years. the initial purpose of that particular project is to try and develop a curriculum for training and education of natives once these wind systems start getting into the bush, so we can try and alleviate some of the problems that have been experienced in putting machines into communities and then having problems with operation and maintenance. So we're hoping that the Kotzebue windmill can help serve in that capacity. We will be working with the university to try and get some curriculum going. The main reason I'm here, and it's where the major emphasis has been on the project, is for the Nelson Lagoon village. It's been our belief, and I continue to feel it is, that one of the answers or partial solutions to the very severe power problems and energy costs of the bush would be the use of wind power as a supplemental energy source. In that process, we decided that what was really needed was a demonstration, and I like to emphasize demonstration. It is an experiment. This is not a wind system that you can immediately go out and know it's going to last for 20 years, but it's actually what it was originally designed. We wanted to try it in an actual village environment on a fuel displacement basis. That is, rather than relying totally on the wind system, you would continue to have diesel backup if you needed it. And Mr. Adler will explain how that works. The site of Nelson Lagoon out on the Alaskan Peninsula was chosen. It's about 30 miles from Fort Mahler and 90 miles from Cold Bay. It's on a long spit, which you'll see. It's a community of about 50 people. It is a community that actually is fairly well off. The people are fishermen. It's very progressive. The community leaders are quite enthused about the potential for the wind power out there, and they are quite capable of maintaining the electrical or the diesel systems that are now there. One of the reasons we selected the site was because of the size of the community, the fact that we wanted someplace where we would have good community support and where the people were capable of supporting it. In November of last year, or late October, we got the wind system up and operating, and it operated for approximately a month. And during that time, we withstood one of the highest wind storms out there, in recent years anyway, 90 to 100 mile an hour winds. There was a fairly high earthquake there. And then approximately a month later, we had an unexpected event, which was very disappointing. What happened is there was vibration. Well, what ultimately happened is we lost the blade, pre-stress on the tower, and what happened is the whole thing just sort of fell over and was sitting like this up there. It was not what we expected. We know we were going to have problems, but we didn't expect the tower to buckle. So we were very disappointed about what happened. Our office and our consultants got together with Grumman, and basically we looked at the thing, what possibly could have happened, and where do we go from here? A couple of theories exist as to what happened. I don't know if we'll ever know really, but I think it's twofold. Number one is the villagers had observed that as the wind machine was turning in to respond to gusts, that it was getting a yawing motion on it, and there was starting to be quite a bit of vibration there. Eventually the vibration kept up, and you could see where the blades were actually hitting the guy wires when it would come down. The other theory is, is that the tower buckled first and was not stressed properly. I've got to admit that in the zeal for saving money, we originally located some FAA towers at Cold Bay. And we thought, well, boy, this is the way to do it, because it's only 90 miles from the village, and we'll cut them down to the proper size. We did have the tower designed analyzed by both the Grumman engineers and by our consulting engineer, and the stress analysis looked fine, that that particular tower could withhold the type of stresses that this wind system would have. After the thing buckled over, I discovered, much to my dismay, and hindsight is always easy, that the way the FAA had brought these towers down at Cold Bay is they had dynamited them. So it's very conceivable, even though we were dealing with straight members, that we had no idea what kind of stress or fatigue had been placed on them. So that it's quite possible also that the tower was not up to its original strength. I tend to think that probably the cause of it was twofold. In our contract with Grumman, their only obligation to us was to replace the wind system. But it was to our interest and to their interest that we shouldn't dwell on whose fault it was that the tower went down. And that the important thing was to try and get the demonstration up and operating as soon as possible again. Because it is the first time it's been done and approached this way in the entire country. So what we made was an agreement with Grumman that they would cover the cost for the reinstallation. We fabricated a brand new tower that's about twice as strong as the original one, and have, in fact, improved on the original wind system as a result of the accident. And if you'd like, Mr. Adler can tell you what they did do. And we have the thing back and operating again. The agreement was that Grumman would pay for the reinstallation if we would go in and request a supplemental appropriation from the legislature to try and cover the installation cost. I might add that the expense to Grumman versus what we agreed to pay for the second installation is quite a bit different. Grumman has invested $200,000 of their own money in this project to date, and we're only requesting $58,000 for the supplemental. The whole arrangement has been very much of a good faith cooperative effort. Not only is Grumman involved, but the Alaska Power Administration has contributed. Originally they put in $20,000 and then $10,000 for the reinstallation. The village has contributed labor. They've also contributed a portion of an RDA grant to help with the project. The Department of Energy in Washington is contributing instrumentation so that we can properly monitor and analyze the progress of the demonstration and to provide some funding to actually do the analysis. Enthusiasm for the concept of wind power hasn't been daunted at all. We still think it's a viable thing. It's something that happened, and we will continue to run into problems. But what we're trying to prove or to demonstrate, what kind of technical problems are we going to run into in these wind systems? Here in Alaska, we've got freezing problems. We've got salt spray deterioration problems, extreme cold. What about operating these kind of equipment in a remote rural environment? How fail-safe do the mechanisms have to be? It's the economics of wind power, just in fuel payback alone, are almost there. They could be paid back at the existing projected production costs in about 4 or 5 years. But we don't know if they're going to last, if they'll hold up. And we've got to find this out, and this is the whole purpose of the demonstration project. Frank will now just tell you a bit about the wind system and how it works, how it ties into the diesel grid.
Could we ask you a question?
Sure.
Be sure that I make you straight. Originally, the legislature provided $250,000 for 3 demonstration machines.
Yes, sir.
Of that, you only got 2.
Correct.
And one of those went gunny sack.
Well, it's going to be covered because it's a fixed cost contract. But you mean gunny sack, the Nelson and Boone one, or the
Apache? Apparently, as I understood it, you're originally 250,000
$100,000 for three machines, you only got two, and now you're back, you want $58,000 more to get the second one, the number two, back in. Is that it?
Yeah, it's actually back up and operating. Grumman has paid the cost to get it up and operating. And the agreement is that if you approve the supplemental, we will reimburse Grumman the $58,000, for their expenses in the second installation.
Whose fault was the first one, or did you have, let me rephrase that. It would seem to me that, in a situation like this, that you would have bought the machines and paid for them in place and operating with some kind of a guarantee. Wouldn't that be the normal procedure?
Well, we're dealing with demonstration equipment. Originally, Grumman was just a supplier of equipment. And according to our contract, they would replace the machine. I think it was FOB Anchorage. And then it would have been up to us to get it out, back into the village, put up a new tower, and get it back up.
Are they prototype machines? Are they experimental rates of some kind? Or?
No, not actually. This is, I think the first unit was the seventh one produced.
It was the sixth unit, but it still qualifies as a demonstration unit. It's not a production unit, the whole program. One of the reasons Grumman was very interested in this severe location was to prove the viability of the design and incorporate any changes to it that we may learn for production. Theresa was right. When we first got involved, we were under contract just to supply the unit to the state contractor who was going to put the unit at Nelson's Lagoon. When the unit failed, the system failed, the power of the unit, we had talked with the state and asked them if we could take a prime role in managing the program and getting it back up, installing it, checking it out. And we want to stay with the program directly until it proves any economic success in terms of the feasibility of the wind system. And we've been with the program directly since November of last year.
How about the other one of the two? Did it still operate?
Well, we're not quite sure. They got it up and it was twirling in the wind, but no electricity was being generated. And the contractor that we bought it from Windlight in Anchorage, it was scheduled to go out there, I think it was this week or last week, check it out. It didn't get up and operating, it would be replaced with a new unit. The one at Kotzebue is a commercial product. It had them up for years and years and years, and it isn't a prototype at all. So our contract with them is fixed cost, so it's their obligation to give us a unit that operates properly. That's how we're working on it. Just the one we have was not working as it should be.
Just wouldn't it be reasonable to see if you can get at least one of these things working and see how it works before you shove any more state money into it?
Oh, we do have one up and working now, and the one at Nelson Lagoon. It is running.
I thought you said one of them wasn't making electricity.
Well, that was the cost. Okay, I'm sorry if I confused you. There's two separate installations. One is a small 2kW unit from a firm in Australia called Gunlife. It's been making machines for over 20 years. It's the one that's tied into the community college building at Kotzebue. We got the thing up and operating and spinning in the wind, and they discovered it wasn't generating profit. This is the one that the unit will be replaced if it doesn't get going.
But it's not a prototype.
No.
It's something that's been, the one at Nelson Lagoon is somehow different.
Correct. 2 versus 20 kW.
Maybe somebody could explain what the difference is in the non-technical.
Well,
It's bigger than that.
It's a lot, lot bigger. there are no commercial units on the market.
That's not very difficult.
There are no commercial units on the market larger than, I believe, it's 6 or 8 kW. To give you some idea of size, it's my understanding that an average urban home consumes between 6 and 8 kW on an average. That's in the point in time. With all the electrical appliances you've got. A 2 kW unit produces the equivalent of, what is it, 2,800 watt bulbs. It doesn't produce a lot of electricity. A 20 kW unit would supply enough power, if we're talking about urban homes, for approximately 3 homes. One thing that we'll learn at the Nelson Lagoon project is another thing is sizing. Is 20 kW too small, or should we be talking about 30 or 40 for a windmill farm concept in these communities? If you only need one, you only put up one. If you need two, one of the problems in the bush, of course, is logistics. If you get these units too big, there's no way in the world you're going to get them out there. The 20 kW unit at Nelson Lagoon, just to give you perspective of size, it's three bladed, each blade is 12.5 feet long. The entire unit weighs 2,500 pounds. I think you'll get some appreciation for the size of it when you see the film.
Where is Nelson Lagoon?
It's near Cold Bay, about 90 miles, I think it's south.
Is the film that went down? Is the one we've seen the film, the old one?
It'll be interspersed. It's film clips, and you'll see the difference. I'll point out the difference when we're showing the film. It looks the same.
Do you have anyone here that can explain the mechanics of one of those windmills?
Yes, sir. Mr. Adler is going
to
do that.
Explain to me then why if you had a windmill running somewhere that it doesn't have a mechanism on it that closes it off and stops it from running when the wind's blowing at any height.
It does.
Well, then why wasn't it stopped instead of watching somebody standing there and watching the blades cut the guy wires in two so the tower fell down?
Well, we don't know exactly what the villagers were observing because we got it after it happened. Someone said you could see it wobbling up there, and they didn't know if that's the way it was supposed to go, or if that's the way, I think perhaps if we would have been smarter and said, does this thing shut her down?
You just put something out here in the boonies and turn it on and go away back to Anchorage and it just runs, is that it?
Well, no, sir. The villagers were watching it, and from what they could tell, it was functioning properly. It's what is the extent of vibration.
Well, it's cutting the guy wires in two?
Well, they didn't observe that. They just noticed that there was some vibration up there. The only reason we knew the guy wires were being hit was because the blade showed it. And the thing went down in the middle of the night. No one watched it.
Shall we see the film?
You can either do that, Mr. Chairman, or Mr. Allard can tell you a little bit about the mechanics, whatever you like.
I suspect we better see the film and then we'll get back to questions. Isn't
okay.
Any better?
Sure.
We have a better idea what you're up to bad.
Yeah. Chuck King has been out there in the village for about 2.5 weeks waiting for it to get up and operate. And the minute they got it turning, he had to take off to someone else.
I tried to.
The wind system and how it works.
Well, Nelson Lagoon is a community consisting of 10 homes, a community building, and a school. The state has installed a grid which ties the houses and the community center to the diesel generating system. Now, the Windstream 25, which ties into this grid, utilizes a 25-foot diameter downwind three-bladed self-aligning rotor to extract up to 20 kilowatts of electrical power from the wind. And this is in a 29 mile per hour wind. And the reason we use a downwind rotor is we don't need to supply a large sail area to align it with the wind as you would with an upwind rotor. It's a passive self-regulating system, so as the wind shifts, the actual motion of the rotor itself aligns itself with the wind.
Well, that's because it's a downwind.
That's because it's a downwind rotor.
Why can't you do that with an upwind rotor?
The upwind rotor needs a large sail area downwind of itself to align it. I think you've seen possibly some of the old style windmills that have a gigantic thin. The size of this machine, which you saw, where the blades just tower over a man's head, the amount of sail you need is phenomenal. The machine itself interfaces with the local grid through a three-phase Gemini synchronous inverter, and Gemini is a trade name. It's a commercially available synchronous inverter. And this automatically converts the wind turbine generator power to synchronized AC with the grid and distributes the wind-derived power to the users. There is no monitoring required of this system. As the wind comes up and the windmill is producing power, it just automatically synchronizes it with the grid, and what happens is the diesel generators will